So I'm here today with Ron from Consulting Rooms, and I thought today we perhaps could talk about some of the sort of trends, some of the things that you that Ron thinks are going to happen, you know, in 2011. So are you happy with that, Ron?
Yeah, that's fine, Adrian. That's great.
Brilliant. So I know there's been a lot of sort of change in the industry, companies buying other companies. Can you just give me a little update on what's going on there?
Yeah, I think last year we saw, consolidation in different sides of the industry. So last year you had BMI, who purchased Transform, obviously one of the biggest cosmetic surgery providers or groups in the UK. Hospital Group acquired Surgicare. So I think that's reflective of the market conditions at the moment, especially in the surgical part of the market, where growth has been, I think, less robust than it was maybe 5 years ago. And also pricing as well has become more competitive. So I think these sorts of companies look at acquisitions to try and reduce their expenditure cost base and maximize profitability in that type of environment. And I think we've also seen that as well in the supply part of the market. So we've seen Syneron and Candela merge to become the biggest laser company in the world now and overtake Luminous. We've got the potential purchase of QMed by Galderma, which I think we'll know about within the next sort of week or two. And also Luminous as well put their aesthetic laser division under Sigmacom, which is quite a big move after being after operating under their own division and brand in the UK for a good number of years. So I think all of this is really reflective of still continuing tougher market conditions and companies looking at how they can maintain and maximise profitability in that environment.
Have you got any figures on, you mentioned that you think surgery may be down a bit. I know it was in America a few years ago. Do you think that's affecting us now, Ron?
Well, I think, if you look at stats from the American Society of Aesthetic Plastic Surgeons, which I think have a cohort of around 14,000 members, it's quite a large group. Now, again, when you look at these surveys, you don't know how many people contribute to it, but I think they seem to think that certainly in the last decade, cosmetic surgery procedures declined by 3% from the start to the end. So certainly in the States, there's been a decline. I think that's partly been due to the rise of the non-surgical treatment section in that sort of 10 years. In the UK, I just don't think we have any good figures. The best ones are Barts from a cosmetic surgery perspective that show modest growth. But they're talking about, sort of 35, 40,000 procedures. And obviously they're not reflective of the entire marketplace because you don't take into account the groups like Hospital Group, Surgicare, et cetera.
Yeah.
But if you look at, I was looking at Transform's report that certainly showed a flattening in growth and a reduction in profitability when you look at their company report. So, I think looking at some of the bigger companies and actually looking at their financial statements does give you a fairly good idea of companies, especially that have been in the market since, the late 70s, I think, Transform was formed.
Yeah.
To say that, I think that the cosmetic surgery part of the business is probably struggling a little bit more compared to the non-surgical, although there are far more non-surgical providers out there now as well, and the barriers to entry are fairly low to that, as you know.
Yeah.
You can spend £400 on a Botox for the training course and be out there advertising your services in a beauty salon.
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier that beauty therapists performing dermarola treatments. Is that right?
Well, yeah. The dermarola or medical needling, if you want to call it, from a generic perspective, has grown tremendously in the last sort of 5 years. So although aesthetic care may only distribute and sell the dermarola to clinics that are doctor-led, there are other companies out there that are more than happy to provide them to beauty salons. Now, of course, there are different versions of the dermarola as well, or these medical leading devices. And so there are some that are for home use, which are really looking at just opening up channels in the skin to enhance the penetration of any sort of topical cream that you're going to put on your face, through to 1.5 mil or longer needles where, you're definitely going to make them bleed and cause an injury, and that's the concept. And in the wound healing phase, improve skin texture, tone, and maybe reduce wrinkles and improve the overall complexion of the skin. So what we've seen is that the accessibility of that and accessibility to training has now gone down to a non-medical level, and they're able to access more aggressive medical needling devices. Yeah. And seemingly get insurance for it as well. And that's a similar trend as well with obviously the injectables as well, where some insurance companies are willing to cover beauty therapists for Botox and fillers.
Do you think many beauty therapists are performing Botox and filler treatments, Ron?
I don't think anyone knows, to tell you the truth. But anecdotally, undoubtedly, there are more now than there were 5 years ago, and that's partly because there are companies out there that are actively promoting training to that segment of the market. Even though there is debate amongst the different organisations like BABTAC and HABIA as to whether or not this should be something that they should support.
Yeah.
Personally, I don't think it's a good idea.
No.
At all, and I've said that many times, but it is a trend that does seem to be continuing, and I think this partly comes down to the fact that when you look at the history of the use of toxins and fillers especially back in the 80s, then the whole business model revolved around nurse injectors predominantly back in those days actually
yeah.
going and servicing beauty salons, and so lots of people are very comfortable with going to that environment and having these sorts of treatments.
Yeah.
And I think it's just an extension from there where, you know, beauty therapist looks and says, well, you know, why should I only take a small cut of this?
Yeah.
If I can get training and do it myself. So it's a commercial drive rather than necessarily one that I think is something that people are doing because they think is, you know, something that's right necessarily.
But just remind me, Ron, I mean, Botox and toxins are prescription-only drugs. Isn't it illegal for non-medically trained professionals to administer them?
Well, one would think so, but it all comes down to being able to administer them under the supervision, well, under the auspices of a doctor or
yeah.
a dentist. Somebody's covering the prescription at the end of the day, and somehow or other, even though I think a number of people, including, you know, the IHAS as well, with their self-regulation scheme that have been looking at sort of lobbying on behalf of the industry to try and improve standards and looking specifically at these sorts of issues as well. And I know currently they will not allow non-medical people to join their self-regulation scheme and their website. They feel it's not acceptable for consumers to go to non-medical people for these sorts of treatments.
Mm.
But legally, I think it's a very grey area. So I'm not really sure how it's going to pan out over the next couple of years, really.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Ron, could I just drag you back a little bit onto these mergers? Now, you mentioned
yes.
that Galderma might be buying QMed.
Yes.
Can you just fill me in on state of play with that?
Yeah, I mean, they made a statement on their website of an intent to purchase, and I think really this now comes down to negotiations and whether or not both parties can see eye to eye for a deal to be done. But apparently some conclusion will become available this month, so we should know one way or another.
Yeah. Now, just remind me, so Galderma a much bigger company than QMed?
Yeah, I mean, I think Galderma is actually owned by Nestle,
right?
As well, and so Galderma in and of itself is obviously a large pharmaceutical company that's predominantly really involved in dermatological treatments, dermatological products. So that's if you asked anyone in the medical profession who they would associate Galderma with, it would be with skin,
right?
So what they've done, obviously, recently is to form an association with, with Spable Pharmaceuticals to license in the ability to be able to promote Azulor. And so that really brought them into the aesthetic marketplace last year. And then they've just recently launched an MCAT as well, Emavel, which is a new hyaluronic acid filler as well. So they're, you know, adding to their pipeline. Now, how that all sort of comes into play if they take on Restylane as well, I'm not really sure. Now, they'll obviously have to work that out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, they're interesting times, I think. And all of this really revolves around, I think, companies looking ahead over the next sort of 5-10 years and saying, well, you know, can we survive and become a profitable organization with the structures we are at the moment, with the pipeline that we've got at the moment as well? And I think that's probably been QMed's problem, is that they haven't had a good, strong pipeline of additional products to sort of bring.
Yeah. So just from Ron, can you just remind me, so QMed, are they privately owned?
I believe they are, yes.
Yeah.
I know it's Swedish-based, but I believe it is a privately owned company.
Yeah, and they were obviously the first, really, with the hyaluronic acid. So they sort of suffered...
Yes, I mean, they came in 1996, actually, with Nasha technology. So, yeah, they back then it was Zyderm and Zyplast.
Yeah.
And they were competing against it. Obviously, they took a very big market share very quickly because of the lack of the need to patch test.
Yeah, so they had a really good sort of product, but other people have adopted similar products.
Well, yes, I mean, hyaluronic acid is, I believe, not that difficult to make and manufacture from a bulk perspective. And so what you tend to find is that, and this is why it's interesting, I think, to look at, you know, if you can do, the data behind the source of the hyaluronic acid as well. There are companies that will buy hyaluronic acid from a bulk manufacturer and then put it under their own brand. In essence, it could be identical to a similar product under a different brand.
Right.
And then it comes down to, you know, presentation, marketing, promotion, pricing, all that kind of stuff, really. So there are some of the, there are dozens and dozens of hyaluronic acid fillers out there. So some of them could be identical. Others might have an actual performance edge due to either the linking structure, particle size, the potential for adverse events, immunogenicity, stability of the product, that kind of stuff. But unfortunately, it's very difficult to sort of tease that out from certainly the marketing data and information that's provided by companies.
Yeah, and I think in the next podcast, we're going to talk about, you know, all the different sort of types of fillers on the market and the different toxins on the market, and also a bit
yeah.
about lasers. But any sort of predictions for this year? So we think the surgery's down a bit, the non-surgical, how's that holding up, do you think?
I think, from our own clinic that we've been running now for 8 years, we had a good long hard look at that last year with the injectable side of things, and we grew, but not by the same amount as we have done in previous years. And I think that's partly been due to the fact that it's been much more difficult to acquire new clients.
Yeah.
And I think that's because there are so many more competitors out there, and price points have declined significantly. We saw an advertisement literally just over Christmas, and it was done through Groupon, which is one of these sort of voucher sites that bangs emails out, you know, deal of the day type of thing. And we've seen the lowest one yet, which is £40 for Botox, which just makes it, you know, cheaper than a facial, really. It's crazy. And that directed back to, it was a dentist, and, you know, when you looked at their site and looked at their kind of profile, it was obvious that they just recently probably learnt to do injectable treatments and been persuaded that this was a really good idea to try and kind of, you know, get clients in the market.
Yeah. So do you think, I mean, you mentioned prices have gone down. I mean, any data about that?
Well, I think the surveys that we've done year on year, which we tend to do with the consulting room, basically show for, I would say, the medical aesthetic clinics, which are the ones that are probably more sort of doctor or practitioner led, or the bigger groups, the prices have been fairly stable over the last 10 years or so. So in real terms, you probably had price deflation because of inflation, if you see what I mean.
So
people haven't been able to put up their prices in the quality clinics. Around the edges of that, in terms of looking at offers and other providers and maybe sort of the part-time practitioners or the people with the roving business model where you're going to service salons, obviously that model is more potentially more profitable because you don't have the overheads of running a business and a clinic and staff and all that kind of stuff. And so we've seen there, you know, kind of crazy offers that have been, it's been much easier to make those offers more visible to a wider proportion of people because of the internet now as well. So you've seen those offers that have been done either through Facebook or through things like Groupon or just put out on blogs, and so they get out there more. And so, yes, we've seen prices go down, and, or pay-per-click marketing. You know, there's all these sort of areas to make prices very visible to large groups of people.
Yeah, yeah.
And go down and down and down, basically, to this kind of £40 mark, which is, you know, you can't make money out of that. And so people are working on the basis of bringing in people on a loss leader.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, and then hoping that then they'll be able to upgrade them to, you know, £200 or whatever you're going to charge for an area Botox. My problem is, I think, in terms of bringing those people in, you set their expectations at a very different level.
Yeah.
And I think those sorts of people are more likely, more often than not, to, instead of coming back to you for another treatment, is to look for the next deal that's out there that somebody else is going to offer. So.
Yeah,
I don't think it's a very good strategy at all.
No, I did hear a story of someone who was advertising Botox very cheaply, and it transpired that it was for sort of one eye, so one crow's feet area, which not many people want, you know, that sort of.
Well,
look.
I mean, but maybe unless you've got, I don't know, hemifacial spasms or something like that, I don't know. No, I mean, and again, it doesn't give people a very good feel about that when they come into a business, because they then feel that they've been, you know, misled.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like the one thing I hate, really hate, are like fares for plane fares or train fares that are advertised, and you kind of look at it and it's one way.
Yes.
And doesn't include most of the other things on there. And by the time you get to the end of it, it's probably just as expensive as, you know, going to BA or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I would 100% agree with you. So, Ron, well, thank you very much for joining us today. So in the next episode, we're going to be talking a little bit about you know, the different toxins that are available. So please tune in for that. Thank you very much for joining us today, Ron.
Thank you, Adrian.